Hey, superhero fans, this is John Semper Jr., writer-producer of Spider-Man the Animated Series and the upcoming War of the Rocketmen. Wow. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello once again, and welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, and I'm taking a look back at Spider-Man, the animated series from the 90s. Started a few episodes back with J. Jonah Jameson himself, television legend Ed Asner. He was on episode 120, so I hope you caught that one. Last week, Spider-Man himself, Christopher Daniel Barnes, who talked about bringing old Webhead to life. That was a fun chat. This week, I've got Spidey's real boss in the lair. It's his real boss from the show, the executive producer and head writer of Spider-Man the Animated Series. Lots to chat about today, so take a listen to this, and then I'm going to be right back for a treasury-sized talk fest with John Semper Jr. Not long after graduating from Harvard, John started his career in Hollywood, and he has since developed, written, and produced hundreds of hours of television, working on shows like Scooby-Doo, Super Friends, The Smurfs, DuckTales, and Static Shock. But it's a 1994 animated series we're celebrating here on Comic Book Central, the one where John, an admitted Spider-Man fanboy, got to write some of his most powerful stories. Spider-Man the Animated Series. John had a hand in writing nearly every one of the show's 65 episodes, which featured a who's who of Spider-Man's rogues gallery and adaptations of classic Spidey comics. Currently, John is crowdfunding a new animated series called War of the Rocketmen. It's a throwback to the cliffhanger serials of the 30s and 40s, starring the original voice cast of Spider-Man.
The year is 1942. My name is Skyler King. My friends call me Sky. I had always wanted to fly. And when World War II began and I enlisted, I saw my chance and trained as a pilot. One night, when I was on a mission to transport a top-secret weapon from Washington to New Mexico, I encountered a powerful storm. In the midst of thick clouds, I spotted small, dark shapes, at first streaking toward the plane, but then flying alongside of it. They were men. Flying men. But how could that be? I was shocked by what they were using for propulsion. There were jetpacks strapped to their bodies. I watched in horror as they landed on both wings of the airplane. These flying men appeared to have magnetic boots that clung to the sturdy metal wings of the transport plane. Emblazoned across their helmets were swastikas. These were Hitler's soldiers. I was under attack.
And fans of Four Color Adventures will soon be able to flip through page after page of John's storytelling as he's been brought into DC Comics' mega event Rebirth as the writer of the superhero Cyborg. I'm continuing my look back at Spider-Man the Animated Series with the producer and head writer of that series. His latest projects include the rebirth of Cyborg for DC Comics and a trip back to the 1940s with War of the Rocketmen. Joining me in the lair today is John Semper Jr. John, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you for having me, Joe. It's great to be here.
Thanks for being here. I'm loving going back and looking at this series. I spoke with Spidey himself, Christopher Daniel Barnes. We talked about it. We talked about War of the Rocketmen. You're getting the band back together again.
I am indeed. I am very lucky in that somehow I did not piss any of them off 20 years ago, and they're all still my good friends.
As producers do, yeah. They kept all the phone numbers. You got everybody's contact information.
It's funny because for most of them, I've actually seen them a lot over the last 20 years. We've gone to different events. Some of them are close friends, and so we've gotten together socially. But I've stayed in touch with all of them, and so there really hasn't been a 20-year gap. They've been my good friends for all of these years.
I was gonna say, you got most of the cast, I think, back together for the 20th anniversary. Mm-hmm. You guys kind of reunited. You even had a little video segment, I think, from Ed Asner jumped in, kind of joined you guys there.
Absolutely. That was fun. Obviously I hadn't kept in as close of a touch with Ed, just because he's a busy guy. But when I contacted him and asked him if he would do the little audio that I, you know, put under the still picture of him, he was excited about it, and he was thrilled and delighted, and it was great. It was a great reunion. We had a good time. It was at Stanley's Kamikaze Expo here in LA, and we were playing to a sellout house. They were turning people away.
That's, I mean, well, it's a great series. We'll talk about that. And yeah, Ed likes to play along. I mean, he played along with a couple of rounds of Match Game here on the show. So I never know how that's going to go, but he's like, oh yeah,
he's
Gene
a great
Raper.
Guy.
He is. He just plays along. And I kind of threw out like Lou Blank, and he's like, comes up with Ferrigno. I'm like, okay, he's playing, you know, he's a good guy. So yeah, we'll chat more about that. Well, obviously Spider-Man, we're going to talk a lot about that. Your maiden voyage into the world of writing DC Comics with Cyborg, we're going to talk about that. War of the Rockman. First, I'd like to find out what sparked your interest in comic books. When did all this begin? You're a fanboy, right?
I'm very much a fanboy.
Anybody that sees your Facebook page, I think.
And by the way, I am on Facebook every day, so if anyone wants to try to get in touch with me, that's the place to go. And I have one devoted, a page devoted specifically to Spider-Man called, you go to www.facebook.com/MakingOfSpider-Man The Animated Series. All one word, Making of Spider-Man The Animated Series.
Yeah, because there's a bunch of them out there, I think, too. So that's like, that's yours.
That's mine.
You know all, and you've got stuff that you've got stuff from the show.
Like I am.
You're pulling out of the boxes.
I kept everything. I knew that this day would come when it would actually have some value. It's funny. I did get rid of a lot of stuff, but not the really important stuff.
Okay. Do you recall your first comic book?
I kept boxes and boxes. Oh yeah. Okay. Well, going back to your question, I don't really. I've been reading comics ever since I was a kid, and. I remember reading, Dennis the Menace, and I remember reading all the Terry Toons characters and Woody Woodpecker and all of those kinds of comics. And then eventually segueing over to DC with Superman and Batman, back in the old days. And then when I was in high school, I started noticing, because back in those days there were no comic book stores, so you simply got comics either on the stand in your local pharmacy or in the subway, where they were hanging on a rack. And I started noticing these strange superhero characters that were from a company called Marvel Comics. And I must have missed that amazing fantasy with Spider-Man by just about a month or two.
Oh, wow. Okay. Issue two or three?
I was issue two or three and started
with
Fantastic Four. No, that's a funny story. One day I decided that I was never going to get to do anything really cool in comic books. This is a lesson. This is a life lesson, folks, for all you kids out there. I was being a little depressed, and I thought, I was out here in Hollywood, and I was trying to, get a career going. And I just didn't think that I was ever going to get close to anything that was going to be cool, like anything Marvel. And I think that they had announced the Spider-Man show, and they had announced it with a different showrunner. And I was busy working on a PBS show of very little renown. It's been completely forgotten. It was called Puzzle Place. I just thought, I've been carrying these comic books around for years and years and years, and they're not doing me any good, and I'm just going to sell them all off. And even then, they were worth a pretty good amount of money. So I actually sold my Spider-Man collection. I sold all my Marvel comics, and my main character had been Spider-Man, so I sold the Spider-Man comics. It was right after that I got a phone call from Stan Lee asking me if I wanted to work on a Spider-Man show.
Wow. Well, at least all the stories were still in your brain. I mean,
well, no, the funny thing was, I immediately, there was a guy named Russell Utzler. Russell, if you're out there anywhere, hello. I haven't seen him in 20 years, but it was a fellow named Russell Utzler. I had sold all my comics to him, and I called him up, and I said, Russell, I've been asked to do the Spider-Man show. Can you sell me back those comics? And furthermore, I had gotten permission from the powers that be at Marvel Films Animation to purchase as many of the Spider-Man comics as I could and basically have on hand a library. So,
This was like work related and they funded it
completely. They did.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, score.
Yeah. So I called Russell and he sent me back a whole bunch of my comics. And then also he and another guy found the ones that I didn't have. And we had a pretty good collection of Spider-Man comics when I started the show.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. So you didn't have to remember everything. Well, it's good that they funded it, too.
You'll have to forgive me because I have a long story for everything, so I'm just going to go into it. I went to them being Avi Arad, who is our executive producer, and I said, Avi, I need a complete collection of Spider-Man comics. They don't need to be originals. They can be reprints, but I have to have this resource. And he said, oh, well, you know, you have Stan Lee right down the hallway. Well, Stan can't remember what he had for lunch earlier that day, you know, an hour earlier. And I thought,
and Grant,
I said,
you're going back 30 years worth of stories, too. It's not like Stan committed these to memory.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not like Stan wrote everything because, you know, now we were doing this in the early 90s and you know, there had been a whole decade of Spider-Man comics that Stan had nothing to do with.
Right.
So I convinced them to give me the money to buy a complete run and they did. So
producers, they're trouble. They're nothing but trouble, right?
Always.
So you're an East Coast guy. Are you from Boston originally?
I am. I'm from Boston originally, and yeah. So I was in Boston subways when I was buying this first Marvel comics, and I loved Marvel. I fell madly in love with Marvel, and my number one hero was Spider-Man. So.
Okay. Well, it all worked out. So how did you? Okay. So take us back to that time period. So high school, college. Mm-hmm. Breaking into animation, children's programming. Kind of walk us through and what were your goals at that time and how did you go about achieving them?
Well, I wanted to get into film. I'm very single focused. I have been my entire life. When I was a kid, I wanted to be an animator. So from an early age of maybe like 5 or 6, I decided I wanted to be an animator. I was very in love with Disney. And Sleeping Beauty was a huge film in my life. I had never seen anything as magnificent as Sleeping Beauty, especially that action-adventure scene at the end when Prince Philip kills the dragon. That kind of set the pattern for the rest of my life. Went to high school, went to a private high school in Boston, Roxbury Latin, the oldest private high school in America. Subsequently went to Harvard. Harvard was not very big on film. A lot of universities at that time were not very big on film. It was still considered pretty much a trash art form. So
that was more of an LA thing, right?
More or less. I mean, you know, USC and UCLA were the only places, and I think NYU, these were the only places where you could get a degree in cinema. Very different from today. But Harvard had a department called the Visual and Environmental Studies Department, which was mostly for guys who wanted to go on and do architecture, go to architecture school. But there were some really cool people. There was a guy named Rudolf Arnheim, who had done a lot of great work in film theory. There was a fellow there named Al Gazzetti. I think he's still there. And he was really into Godard. He was teaching film courses, you know, and was really into Godard. So we had to watch a lot of Godard movies. Jean-Luc Godard. To this day, I can't stand those films.
Well, when you're forced to watch them, yeah. I mean, it's like it wasn't your choice to watch them.
Yeah, they're horrible movies. But
there's
anyway,
nobody in spandex flying around in them.
Yeah, that's the problem. And, you know, I had a film series. I had a film society at my house. Harvard is broken up into houses, and because I lived off campus, since I was from Boston, I didn't have to live on campus. And my house at Harvard was Dudley House. And Dudley House had this one big hall called Lehman Hall. I think I worked it into an episode of Spider-Man the Animated Series. There is a Lehman Hall somewhere in one of the
episodes. I'll have to look for it.
And I had the Dudley House Film Society. And I ran. Everybody was running Godard and Truffaut and Bergman and all of these kinds of characters. Directors. I was running Republic Serials, and I was running.
I sense Commando Cody's coming up somewhere.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, that's where all that started. I would run an entire serial in one night, so all 15 chapters, all 12 chapters. Zorro's Fighting Legion, King of the Rocket Men. I also did Disney stuff, and I had lines around the block. Nobody was going to the other film societies to see the Godards and the Truffauts and all that. Everyone was coming to see. You know, 3 episodes of Zorro that I had in my film collection. So, you know, that was really the way it was going to go for me. And at that time, Harvard had this, you know, Visual and Environmental Studies Department. It was the only place where you could get to play with movie cameras. And they had an Oxbury animation stand in the basement, which they were the only ones, I think, on the East Coast, one of two entities on the East Coast that had an Oxbury animation stand. And so that was the only place where you could play with film. Being in Cambridge, Massachusetts, there was also this wonderful movie theater that got started called the Orson Welles Cinema, which was a revival movie cinema that was probably one of the best in the nation at that time. And I started working at the Wells, and I became a manager there. And that was also very seminal in my development, thinking about film. In fact, I think working at the Wells was – I learned more about film working at the Wells and various movie theaters in Boston than I did actually being at the in the VES department at Harvard. Anyway, I graduated with a degree in VES, which was absolutely worthless to me. and I, because I so desperately wanted to be in the film business, I entered the insurance business.
Which, of course.
You know, you're just pressured to get a job and do the right thing and be the right kind of person. The coolest thing about that job was that they gave me a free car. So that was okay. And I traveled the Eastern Seaboard, I think. My territory went all the way up to Gloucester. But no, that was horrible. And I ended up getting fired. And around about that time, a woman named Audie Bach, who was Akira Kurosawa's translator, she came to me and she said, you know, you're always talking about getting into the film business. I'm driving out to the West Coast to go teach. Why don't you hop in the car and come with me? And again, kids, this is a lesson for you. My first instinct was to say no. And then I went home and I thought about it and I thought, yes, that's exactly what I have to do. And so that that was that particular. That's what brought me out to L.A. eventually.
What a roll of the dice, too. I mean, that's just such a huge chance. But obviously the passion was there. So,
Well, I was just talking about this with a friend the other day. If you don't have the guts to hop in a car and come to L.A. with only a suitcase, then you don't have what it takes to survive in L.A. Because that first big jump that you make is indicative of how you're going to end up having to behave if you want to get into the film industry anyway. No one's ever going to make it easy for you to do anything. In fact, they're going to go out of their way to fight you every step of the way. So if you don't have that singular urge to just get out and do it, you know, because you have to keep doing that. I mean, you literally have to keep doing that almost every week in this business. So, there's another life lesson.
Life lessons all around. Well, I mean, we probably learned a lot of this from superheroes too, you know, just,
you can, if you pay attention.
Those early stories. Yeah. When you get into some of the stories. So, okay. So you get out to LA. Did you break into animation first? Was it children's programming? So you were editing, correct?
I was a film editor.
Okay.
Because
I'm looking at some of these names and it's like, okay, how do you go from, hey, you want to jump in this car to working with Chuck Jones, Walter Lantz, Lou Scheimer, Jim Henson? It's like, okay,
you know,
that just happens to everybody, right?
My career is so weird. What happened was when I was in college, I met a guy, a fantastic friend by the name of Henry Kaiser III. And Henry came up to me one day and he said, I'm really into Japanese film. This is when if you walked up to anyone and said Japanese film, their idea was Godzilla. They would say, oh, you mean Godzilla. And you'd go, no, there are all these directors, Kurosawa and Inoshiro Honda and Ozu, and no one knew anything about these guys. Well, so what happened was Henry said, I'm really into these Japanese films. And he used to get 16mm prints and run them in his dorm room. So we became exposed to Zatoichi and all these really wonderful characters. He had a friend named Sheldon Renan who was doing a TV series. Henry got really plugged into all these people who were bringing Japanese film over to America, which was a brand new thing. And he had a friend named Sheldon Renan who was doing a TV series for PBS called The Japanese Film, which was going to be the very first opportunity that America was going to have to look at real Japanese films that weren't Godzilla and Mothra. So he got me a job working on the set. The intros for the PBS show were being done by Edwin Reischauer, who had been JFK's ambassador to Japan. So, you know, I mean, this is the advantage of being at Harvard, is that all these really amazing people are there. I'm on the set, you know, working doing things like working the teleprompter and running around and doing errands, Sheldon eventually sent me to Washington to get some footage from the Library of Congress. When Sheldon, so we fast forward a couple of years later, when Sheldon found out that I was driving with Audie out to the West Coast, he called me up and he said, well, look, I'm doing this project where someone wants to buy an animation company. And I'm doing research for the entity that's brokering the deal. We're trying to find out what animation company to buy. And you know, I enjoyed working with you on the Japanese film show. So if you're going to come out here, I want you to work for me. And we will run around to all the animation companies. So literally, I arrived in Los Angeles, I think, on a Saturday. And the following Monday, I was meeting Chuck Jones. we began going to every animation company and meeting with the heads of every company. So I met Chuck Jones on Monday, and you know, maybe Tuesday was over Disney, a guy at that time who was in charge of animation. You're never going to believe this, but his name was Donald Duckwall. Duckwall was his name. Yeah. And he had one of the artists had put a picture up on the wall that had a caricature of him, and then Donald Duck was on the other side, and there was a brick wall between them. And Donald was saying, you know, Don, there'll always be a wall between us.
How does it even happen where a guy like that gets – I mean, is he – I think you just go to Disney if you're named that, right? That gets you in the door?
I swear I think Disney renamed them all, you know, because
– I was going to say, there's probably – yeah, there may have been a name change involved there. That seems a little, you know – give me a break.
No, actually, I think that was his real name, and probably that was why he got hired. I think all those old animation guys had names like that, though. Nick Nichols and Ub Iwerks, and you know, they all had names like that. Anyway, so suddenly I'm meeting all the heads of all the animation companies, and meeting Lou Scheimer at Filmation, Joe Ruby and Ken Spears at Ruby Spears. So after that round of doing things, I hit it off really well. I thought to myself, okay, now, you know, that job only lasted about 3-4 months. And then I thought, I'm going to go back to all the guys that I met in those meetings that I really liked or that seemed to really like me. So I went back to Ken Spears. Actually, first I went to Lou Scheimer, and Lou did like me, and Lou wanted me to train as a storyboard artist, because that was, you know, that was what they were needing at that particular time. And I could draw a little bit. I draw okay. But I didn't draw as well as the guys that were working there, number one. And there was a guy there named Christensen, and he just hated me. He just walked in the room, and Lou was trying to tell him that, you know, I should be hired.
He was a storyboard artist, or he was... an exec.
He was like the head of their production.
Okay.
And he just kept shaking his head no. Like, there was no way in hell I was going to work at that company. He was absolutely against it. Right there in front of the boss.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's not a healthy situation. So Lou...
No idea why?
No. Okay. No. But, you know, animation back in those days was a very closed club. If I may even go so far as to say, there were no people of color really in animation back in those days. So, because we're talking, this would be like 79 or 80. I don't know that was the issue, but, you know, it was a very strange industry back then. And there really weren't any young people. There were not that many young people. So I don't know if it was a race issue or a young issue, young old issue, or even just a I don't like your face, you're ugly issue.
Or just the fact there's three of us working here, we don't need a fourth, you know.
Yeah, it was really...
I don't need somebody taking my job.
You know, that's I mean, this guy simply did not want me at the company.
Okay.
So Christensen, his name is on all the Filmation things. Anyway, I thought to myself, well, that's not going to really work out. Also, I was training under this really amazing storyboard artist whose name I'm not going to remember right at the moment, but he was just incredible. His work was brilliant, and I looked at that and I thought, I'll never be this good. Strangely enough, fast forward years later when I'm running Fraggle Rock, he actually did the first board for us. But he, at that time, I just thought, I can't even compare to this guy. So I ignored that, and I went to Ken Spears, whom I had also hit it off really well with. And Ken had me go over to his editorial guy. You know, he said, he said, well, what do you want to do? And Sheldon had given me one really great piece of advice. He said, if anyone ever asks you what you want to do, pick one thing. Don't say, so here's another life lesson, kids. When they ask you what you want to do, don't say, well, I like to write and I like to this and I think I could really draw. Don't do that. Pick one thing. And I decided that the smart thing for me to pick would be editorial, because I knew that I was a pretty good film editor. And a good friend of mine, Dave Stone, was working at Hanna-Barbera as a sound effects editor, and he was making pretty good money. And you know, that seemed like a pretty good job. So I said to Ken, I want to be in the editorial department. And he said, okay, fine, I'll line up an interview with you. So I went over to the editorial department, and while I was waiting to meet with his guy's name, I think, was Dave Spence. And he was the head of the editorial. And while I was waiting to, go in, there was this redheaded guy named Richard Allen, and he was rewinding some film, and we were just chatting away, and he, you know, his wife was from New England, so we hit it off pretty well. Then I went into an interview with Dave Spence, and he didn't like me the minute I walked into the room. You could tell he didn't want me anywhere near him. So I went home dejected, because now I had played out all my cards, and I got a phone call, and it was from the redheaded guy. It was from Richard, and he said, look, he said, Dave doesn't know it yet, but he's about to be fired.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm taking over the department, and I think you're really great. And so if you give me 4 weeks, I will be taking over the department, and I'm going to hire you.
Oh, wow.
And bless his heart, Richard hired me 4 weeks later, I think maybe 4 or 5 weeks later.
Okay.
And that's how I got my first steady gig. I got into the Editors Guild as a result of that. So that began my career as a film editor. And the reason all of this relates to Spider-Man, because now all your audience has gone to sleep, because they're saying, we want to hear about Spider-Man, we're hearing about all this crap. Richard actually ended up being the editor on Spider-Man.
Okay. So, but all along, you're making these contacts that you need to make.
Oh, you know, you bounce around. This is why you need to be here, because you are just tossed and turned by the rapid current and eddies of this particular ocean, and there's no way you can predict any of it. You know, people call me up or people come to town, and I sit down with young people all the time and have lunch. And they say, or it's usually the people that call me up from out of town or email me from out of town and say, how can I get into the business? And I always say the first thing to do is go to where the business is. Go to L.A. or go to New York. If you happen to live in one of those, you know, places like Georgia or someplace where there's a lot of film production going on, go to those places because the kinds of connections that you can make can only be made when you are physically present. If you are not physically present, one guy recently emailed me on the Spider-Man page on Facebook, and he said, you know, I think that I'm going to have a lot of trouble in the industry because, you know, I didn't do any dissertations on film when I was in college. It's like, dude, that has no bearing on anything. No one cares about your college degree. No one cares. All that matters is if you are out here and standing in front of them and they like you and you can do the work. That's all that matters.
Well, again, you make those contacts. And we talked about, Ruby Spears, I think you mentioned?
Yes, yeah.
You get to do some superhero writing.
Well, what happened at Ruby Spears was I was an editor and I got to handle film and I got to see the whole process from the ground up, how it all comes together. When I got laid off at Ruby Spears after one season, maybe, then a lot of us got picked up at Hanna-Barbera editorial. And there, that was even better because they were still making entire cartoons in the building at that time. There was a lot of stuff going overseas, but there was a certain percentage of production that was happening right there in the building from beginning to end. So I could watch the process. I could go into the background artists and watch them painting backgrounds. When I started writing there, it was great because I could watch the whole process of my cartoons. So I'd write a cartoon, and then I could see the background artists painting the backgrounds for that cartoon and the layout people, and then the animators animating. And there was still a little bit of that. Bill and Joe kept a little bit of that happening in-house. And so that was cool. That was a great learning experience. It was the greatest film school that, you know, anyone could have ever gone to. And all the guys in that building were all these old Disney animators. They had all animated the classic Disney cartoons and stuff like that. So, there were a lot of really great people.
Do you remember your episode of Super Friends?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was called No Honor Among Super Thieves. Lex Luthor had gathered together a whole bunch of super thieves to conquer the super friends, and he had succeeded wearing his super suit by, I think, stealing all of their powers or something. And then
he's the X9 meteorite.
And then he turned on Darkseid, and and they got into a big fight amongst themselves, and that enabled the super friends to get free and win the day.
Did you channel anything with that? Like, were you reminded of something, or did you just like the super cool Lex Luthor battle suit that you had to work into it?
Well, all I remember about that series was that it was based on a toy line. Yeah, you know, it was fun. At that time, I was, you know, because that's years later, and I'm at that point, I'm now on staff as a writer. I'm no longer editorial. I did an editorial thing, and I bounced around and did a bunch of things editorially, working for different shows and stuff. And then I came back. I started moonlighting as a writer, and then they invited me back. I sold so many scripts. My partner, Cynthia Friedlob, and I sold so many scripts that they said, well, you guys should come on staff because you're actually selling more scripts than our staff people, wow. Some of our staff people. So they, you know, we then had offices there, and that's when I started writing for everything that was, you know, at that point, again, the greatest animation school you can imagine. At that point, you're writing for every show that Hanna-Barbera does. So you'd be on Smurfs one day and then doing the Jetsons the next day and then doing Super Friends shows that have been totally forgotten like Biscuits. And you just jump around and you do whatever, wherever they needed a writer. Pink Panther and Sons. I was working with Friz Freleng. Friz Freleng was there. They were the number one place to be. That was where all the animation in the world was being done. And you know, all the animation for Saturday morning in America was pretty much coming out of Hanna-Barbera. Yeah. So it was a wonderful place to be in, and I had a wonderful time there.
Okay, well, Super Friends, not the only time the worlds of toy lines and animated series combined. Spider-Man the Animated Series.
Yes.
Boy, this was massive. You mentioned you got a call from Stan Lee.
There was a major sort of big bang that happened, which was when Margaret Lesh, who was the head of Hanna-Barbera production, left Hanna-Barbera and decided to head up another company called Marvel Productions, which had been formerly DePatie Freleng. And Margaret brought us over to Marvel Productions. And now the networks were completely, I mean, they were totally confused because they had always known to go to one place, which was Hanna-Barbera, and that was Margaret. And now it was like Margaret was at one company and Hanna-Barbera was a whole other company. And so everything just kind of blew up at that point. We went with Margaret over to Marvel, and there was a fellow there in a back office by the name of Stan Lee, whom I had worshipped my entire life. So Stan and I, you know, I was like a puppy dog. I would just go hang out in his office and at his feet. And and we would hang out a lot and talk about how crappy it was that we weren't doing any Marvel properties, because mostly everything being done at Marvel Productions was for Hasbro. So the very first show I ever did that I ever ran was called Moon Dreamers, which was a Hasbro toy. I still have a box of them in my storeroom. Anyway, so I'm doing all that stuff, and it was a tremendously creative space. Two doors down from me was Chuck Lorre, who's now the king of television.
Big Bang Theory and...
Yeah, he's like, I mean, there's a building on the Warner's lot called the Chuck Lorre Building, okay? This is a guy who used to have an office two doors down from me, and now when I take the Warner's tour, I'm driving by the Chuck Lorre Building. anyway, there was a young fellow who worked with Jim Henson. Marvel Productions was doing Muppet Babies, which was a highly successful show. Cynthia and I got the opportunity to run one of Jim's shows, Fraggle Rock, which was very important to Jim. And we were sitting across the table from Jim and his people. And one of his people was a young man named Bill Prady, who's the co-creator now of Big Bang Theory. And Bill is actually still somebody that I run into from time to time because he lives here in my neighborhood. That was a tremendously creative situation, and there were a lot of really cool people. And I got to meet Jim Henson and start to work with Jim. Fraggle Rock, the animated series, was a very, very, very important show to Jim because the puppet show had, you know, very limited budget. It had been on a network that nobody watched, a little obscure network called HBO. that nobody was watching in 1983.
Yeah, it hadn't really taken off yet.
Yeah, it hadn't. It was very small. And he was very excited. Jim was very excited that NBC was going to do Fraggle Rock. So I had Jim's full attention. We had Jim's full attention. And he liked this. So that was a wonderful opportunity. Anyway, that's how I met Stan at that time, was working for Marvel Productions. So fast forward a couple of years later, no longer working for Marvel Productions because the company folded.
Yeah, this was a strange time at Marvel too, wasn't it? I mean, this was all the – I mean, they were having financial difficulties. They were trying to get their characters in different versions and things weren't working out.
Yeah, Marvel Productions was not really associated with Marvel. I don't know quite what the deal was, but it really wasn't – had nothing to do with Marvel. But years later – when I got the call, so when I got the call from Stan, he was now, you know, I mean, we were now friends, and he said, I'm having trouble over here. I'm working on a show. We're trying to get Spider-Man off the ground, and we're trying to make a deal with a guy, as a showrunner, and we're having trouble making the deal. So I want to put your name into the hat. And I said, great. And then he called me up a week later and said, well, we made the deal with the other guy. And I said, well, that's all right, Stan. That's no problem. I was working on a show at the time anyway. I was working on a show called Puzzle Place, which, as I mentioned before, no one remembers. Then about 6 months later, Stan gave me a call and he said, it's not really working out with this particular story editor, which I later realized had nothing to do with the story editor. It had to do with the fact that there was one person who was being very Machiavellian, who was silently eliminating anyone that person perceived would get in that person's way. And I think this poor first guy just got caught up in all of that, political maneuvering. But at any rate, I got a call from Stan. He said, it's not working out. We're going to let him go, and I got to bring you in. And this time I'm just telling them, you're coming in. There's not going to be any argument. And I said, great. So I left Puzzle Place, incurring the wrath of all of those people. And I came over to Spider-Man. And Spider-Man, at that particular time, so this answers your question. Spider-Man was a mess. And Marvel Publications was a mess. Now, they're separate entities. Marvel Publications was a separate entity from Marvel Films Animation. Marvel Films Animation was a brand new studio that had been created, and its very first show was going to be Spider-Man, okay? So it's a brand new studio. I believe it was affiliated with New World, and that's where the money was coming from. But the weird thing about the show was that even though the show itself was a New World show, the impetus for the show was to sell toys for Toy Biz, which was a company that Avi owned. So there were almost kind of dual purposes, you know. So even though all the money for the show was kind of coming from New World, the whole reason for the show's existence was to sell these toys that that really New World had no connection with or anything. And then there was Marvel Publications, which had no connection really to any of this, and was a company that was just dying. Their comic books weren't selling, and there were only so many ways you could put Wolverine on the cover of something. It was all very bleak, quite frankly. And they had a big boom, and everybody had bought, you know, all these comic books in the late 80s, and now it had all gone bust. So everything was a mess. And I remember, by the time I came onto Spider-Man, we got a visit from a representative of Marvel, of Fox, the network. And they were basically, they made it clear that, you know, that they were not interested in doing the show anymore. I think they were fed up with the process. They were fed up with the people.
It hasn't even launched yet at this point, had it?
It's nowhere. It hasn't. There hasn't been a script written yet.
Right, because you're in from the beginning. I know, because you wrote the first script. It's like, yeah, this is all like just like, hey, let's try and get this going.
Well, they had really just pissed away 6 months or something. Wow. And everybody was arguing with everybody. I have never seen so much anger. And so the first thing I did was Avi was kind of panic-stricken, because if we didn't get a show out the door by a certain time, then there wouldn't be a show on the air by a certain time, and he needed to have a show on the air by that time, by that, you know, by September, so that there would be toy sales for Christmas. He had a huge toy line rolling out, and there wouldn't be any show. And believe it or not, back in those days, if you're going to sell toys to kids, they didn't know who Spider-Man was. Kids didn't know who Spider-Man was. You know, if you're trying to sell a toy to a six-year-old, he doesn't know who Spider-Man is. He had this entire toy line, huge amounts of money invested in this toy line, and there wasn't going to be a show. And now you've got someone coming over from Fox basically, you know, being very rude to us and saying, you know, well, you know, if we don't get this done by blah, 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 then there's no show. And that was like my second day there. That was like my second or third day there. So I quickly assessed the situation. And in the meantime, there's one person who's slinking and slithering around, trying very desperately to get any writer guy fired. And I always mention this because I know that maybe this person's out there listening, and I always want that person to know that none of that was helpful. There is all this political maneuvering going on. Okay. And in the middle of it, you know, I'm trying to get a show out the door, which was all I cared about.
Is anybody cast at this point? I mean, Asner, nobody.
Honestly don't know what they did between the time that Stan called me and said, we found, you know, a story editor and you're not him and good luck. And then the time he called me and said, we're in trouble. I don't know what was done because when I got there, it's like everything was starting.
Wow.
No decisions had been made. That's how messed up everything was.
Wow.
And I always make a big deal out of this, and I'm sure people are tired of listening to it, but you know, everyone always asks me, so what was it like when you started? Well, it was sheer unadulterated hell when I started. And the first thing I did, the reason we got Night of the Lizard was because I went back to the comic books and I thought, okay, I need to find a comic that has a beginning and a middle and an end. And it's something that Stan wrote, because then no one can argue with it. Okay. So if the basic story is there and it's a story that Stan wrote, then I'm safe. So, you know, the Lizard story is very simple. You know, there's Doc Connors, he changes himself, becomes a lizard. Spidey has to fight him and also change him back. Basic, simple story. And I got, you know, I wrote the Bible for Spider-Man like in a couple of weeks, the show Bible. There was no show Bible that had been written. So I did that, and I started dealing with writers, and that was its own particular nightmare. And then I started having story conferences, and that was a nightmare. But I got the Lizard story approved, and then I brought in Jerry Conway, who is a really great guy. Jerry is a gentleman. He is a wonderful guy, and he's a great writer. And he was already in Hollywood because he was working on Prescription Murder, the Dick Van Dyke show at that time, Diagnosis Murder or whatever it was called. Mm-hmm. And so he very generously agreed to do the first draft. And again, he was a safe choice because nobody could come and say to me, well, you know, this guy Jerry Conway doesn't know Spider-Man. Because that would be stupid.
Yeah.
So
you're bringing in the right people at this point.
It's just all politics, you know, at this point. It's like,
always the thing? It's like, if you want we're seeing that now in these days where if you want, you know, these great characters and these great stories, bring in the people that know the characters. Bring in the comics guys.
Absolutely. One of my funniest memories was our network guy, whom I shall refer to as Dennis the Menace. And he was lecturing us. It was me, Stan Lee, and Jerry Conway in the room. You've got, you know, Stan obviously created the character. Jerry Conway made his mark, his historic mark on the character. And I was about to make a historic mark on the character. And this network guy, Dennis the Menace, is lecturing us on who Spider-Man is. I just remember Stan going, Dennis, I know who Spider-Man is. I created him. It was the most absurd situation on the planet. Yeah. Anyway, enough about all of that. It was a mess, but I got a show out the door.
No, I was interested as to why the Lizard was the first villain chosen. So that
that's why
it kind of ties that up. But
it was safe. It was absolutely safe. And then I followed it up with, I think, the Scorpion,
yeah,
which was another story that had a beginning and a middle and an end. And right in the middle of writing that one, we had the Northridge earthquake. So that was another disastrous period of time.
How did Joe Perry from Aerosmith get involved?
Oh, Abby was on a plane in first class, and he ended up sitting next to him.
Okay. they struck up a conversation, started talking about Spidey?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That was it.
All right.
Very simple.
No, it's interesting how you got the theme song. So that's, yeah, you know, no,
Abby,
again,
Abby was sitting next to him and said, Abby said, hey, you know, it'd be great if you did the theme song. I usually do Avi's voice, but I'll save that. I won't do that.
Okay.
That was what happened. It was really it was cool, actually. I mean, it was very cool of him to do that and make that connection. And I think it was really beneficial to the show.
Yeah, it's an amazing theme.
Avi and I got along really well. I think there were definitely bumpy moments, and I'm not sure that at the end it was on the best of terms. But the majority of the time, you know, I think Avi gets a bad rap from the fans. He made the show possible at the time when no one else could have made the show happen. And during the first 13, he was going to fire me. And then somewhere along the line, he saw the light and he signed me up for the remaining episodes. That was my contract. My contract was I was only on for 13 and then they could let me go. And then there had to be that big moment where it had to be decided whether or not I was going to be signed on for more. But he signed me on for more.
What was the issue? Was it that you wanted the storylines to be one thing and he wanted them to be something? Or what was the issue? Because, I mean, obviously you watched this. You had a hand in writing almost every episode, I think.
I did. I did. Well, we can talk about that. The issue in the beginning in the first 13 was the other person whispering in his ear and trying to get rid of me. And then somewhere along the line, he realized that the other person was not necessarily properly motivated. And then he signed me on for the remaining episodes. So I have Avi to thank for that. We actually had a pretty good relationship for most of the series.
What was the issue, though? Was it between you and these other people? Was it just personality conflicts or was it storyline idea conflicts?
Well, here's what I think it was. I think that what happens in a situation like that is that it's a power struggle, and I was perceived by some people as threatening their position within this new company. You see, it's not just a show, but Marvel Films Animation at that time was going to be like a brand new company that was going to do everything Marvel. And it was sort of like going to be its own Disney studio. And I think that, you know, I came in, my contract was I was in charge of story, period. So that gave me a great deal of autonomy. I was only answerable to Avi. That was it.
Okay.
And I think that threatened some people.
So it's more politics than anything.
And it was totally politics. Okay. It had nothing to do with whether or not I knew what I was doing.
Okay. Do we do the one episode stories as opposed to like the six episode arcs or something like that?
No, nothing like that. I mean, there was a little bit, there was friction about story arcs, but that was the network, you know, and the network didn't want to do continuing storylines. Back in those days, that was not a very popular concept. But I did them anyway because I knew that was what Spider-Man needed. That was what Spider-Man was all about. So, you know, there was a little bit but the network started off being pissed off about me and the show and everything.
You're
remember
just making friends wherever you go, aren't you?
I was dropped into a situation where there were a lot of strong feelings and everybody was so disrespectful to me in the beginning. You know, there was a grace period where I was just sort of willing to be the company guy and do whatever anybody told me. And I got beaten up for it and nearly got fired. After I nearly got fired, I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to make a good show and everybody else can go F themselves. That's why I'm so beloved by all these people today.
And
because I just did that. You know, I just said, you know what, continuing storylines are what's going to make the show great. So we're going to do continuing storylines. And I would get, you know, these subtle suggestions, please don't do the continuing storylines. It'd be really nice if you didn't do the continuing storylines. And I just ignore it, and I did them anyway. And guess what? The show is still popular. You know, you get this old show that's not in high def format and gets on the air, and kids still love it. So obviously, the continuing storylines, I think, are a huge part of that.
Well, I think, and you talk about that first season. I mean, let's talk about some of these episodes and some of the choices that were made. Let's talk about casting. Yeah, we talk. Okay, so even right off the beginning, the Hobgoblin.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought that, first of all, if you're a listener, if you're not on John's Facebook page that he mentioned earlier, get on it because you find out these really cool things. You have a podcast, too, I believe, too, where you get into a lot of different Spider-Man aspects, correct?
I started a podcast, and okay. I intend to continue it one of these days. Yes, okay. But there are a couple of episodes that are on YouTube, absolutely, yeah.
But you get out there, and it's just like, Frank Gorshin was almost the Hobgoblin, right?
Yes. Yeah, Frank Gorshin, we auditioned him.
The Riddler.
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. What happened there?
I don't know, really. You know, I think that when we got Mark Hamill, Mark was doing more cartoon work.
He had already done the Joker at that point.
Yeah, he had done the Joker. And there is a difference between people who are adept at doing cartoon work and people who are not, you know, people who do on-camera stuff. It's a different type of acting, and Mark does both. And I think probably Frank had not had the experience doing cartoon acting. We had some very famous actors on Spider-Man, and some of them would come in and they were absolutely lost when it came to the kind of acting that we were expecting over the microphone, you know. So I think that Mark was just the better choice.
Yeah, he like we've talked about this numerous times on the show, that he just devours the mic
yes.
when he's on
yeah,
there.
Yeah, he's a great actor. Mark is really a good actor.
What was Ed Asner like when he came in? I mean, was it just the whole Lou Grant thing and the Mary Tyler Moore, we just got to get him as the newspaper publisher?
I believe that was the case. I wasn't really directly involved with casting, although down the line as the show progressed, I would make suggestions.
Okay, so you had some input from time to time?
From time to time, but not at the very beginning. I wasn't really a person that chose, you know, that made the final decision. As I say, my domain was strictly writing and stories, so I was perfectly happy to not be involved in some of these other decisions. But I would have to say that when I found myself at the initial read through sitting next to Ed Asner, I could barely breathe. I could barely breathe. I something at that moment said, "You have arrived." And there I was sitting next to TV Hall of Famer Ed Asner. That was a big moment. Then also at the table was Brock Peters. And Brock Peters, of course, was certainly an Academy Award nominated actor who had been in many major motion pictures, and I'd grown up watching him on TV. You know, we would periodically get these people in whom I had worshipped from afar. Edward Mulhare. As a kid, I had watched every episode of the TV show The Ghost and Mrs. Muir.
Yeah.
And suddenly I'm sitting next to Edward Mulhare, and we're having a conversation, you know. Or Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. I had grown up watching 77 Sunset Strip. That was a huge show in my life when I was a kid. Mostly forgotten now, but it was a number one show in America at that time. And there I am now in a room with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. So these are the people that kind of took my breath away. But that first read through, I was sitting next to Ed, I could barely talk.
Yeah. We talked about this with Christopher Daniel Barnes, and it's just like, you know, Batman the Animated Series kind of did this as well, where you bring in these like really huge powerhouses of television history coming yeah. and doing these voices, and it's amazing what they come up with. Yeah, Ed Asner is J. Jonah Jameson. That seems like a no-brainer. I mean, that's just like perfection casting right there. Saratoga Ballantyne, we talked yeah. you know about her as well, played Mary Jane. Was it just because that this was set around the comics of the 90s and the toy line, and Gwen Stacy really hadn't been apart since the 70s? Was that really why there was a – because Gwen Stacy's only in one episode, and it's like an alternate timeline.
Yeah, well, back in those days, first of all, at least as far as Spider-Man is concerned, I invented the alternate timeline because I did that last, you know, bit, that last arc where there are all the different Spider-Men. No
yeah,
one had
Spider
ever
Wars.
Done that before, right? And that had never been done in the comics, so I invented that. And I threw Gwen in just because I knew that there were a lot of people out there who were disappointed that they never got to see Gwen in the series. And that's why I put her in there.
Okay.
And now you've got this, you know, like there's the Spider-Gwen comic book and alternate universes are just an integral part. None of that existed back then. So when I came up with the idea of doing parallel universes with Spider-Man, it was brand spanking new. the decision not to have Gwen Stacy was mine. It was because she died. And in order to do it right, you would have to have her die. And I knew that we could not, at least certainly not in the first season, have a character die. And I wanted to get to Mary Jane as quickly as possible. So if I had Gwen Stacy, she would have to die fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Fox probably
wasn't going to allow that.
No TV network was going to allow death on a cartoon show.
You couldn't throw a punch
for children.
we
could. That's the myth. I have to shoot this myth down.
You talking about this from time to time. And
I hate it. I hate it. The myth is we had.
Didn't you perpetuate the myth a bit?
I started
in all fairness.
It.
Okay,
I started it. I'm the idiot that started it.
In all fairness, I think you. Yeah, you were the origin story.
I used to go to conventions.
Yeah, you used to read your little liner, your notes.
Read the broadcast standards and practices notes for, as a joke. And what I didn't realize was that there were kids out there who were going, oh, wow, we didn't know they had censorship. Wow, that must be something only Spider-Man has. And so it became this myth that, we were just riddled with censorship. And I hate it when I'm online and somebody will say, well, I'd like that show, except, they had censorship and the show sucks. And it's just the dumbest statement on the planet. Every show had exactly the same restrictions that we did, except maybe Batman, where those guys just did stuff. The way I did continuing storylines, those guys just did stuff like throwing people through glass windows and stuff.
Sorry, I just thought it was funny. I just had to bring it up.
Then when the network would catch up with them, they'd go, oh, we're sorry. So we didn't do that. There was no excessive censorship on Spider-Man. End of myth, end of rumor,
We'll put it to rest right here at Comic Book Central. You started it. I'll allow you to end it.
I'm ending it. It's
officially ended.
I never had an argument once with BS&P. It was a lovely lady by the name of Avery Evans, I believe. Never once did I argue with her. By the way, we did do death eventually when that Hydro Mary Jane died. She died, and for a whole generation of kids, that was just traumatic that Mary Jane that Peter had married and had gone on a honeymoon with actually died. So we did do death, and then we did do a gun. We had a gun in that episode with Robbie Robertson and his son, Randy.
Okay.
With Alfonso Ruggiero doing the voice of Randy. That was all about him having a gun, and we showed the gun, and it was a real gun. Unlike the guns in Batman, which were highly stylized, we had a real gun. So, this whole myth that we didn't do these things, please.
Again, you started it. I'll allow you to end it.
I'm ending it here right now.
That's okay. Fine. And speaking of Saratoga Ballantyne, who portrayed Mary Jane Watson, was incredibly. Something I found out about one of your recent convention appearances is that her mom, we talked about the Rock comic with Ron Dante. We talked about it with Rene Auberjonois. He was Spider-Man. I found out that it was her mom is Aunt May.
Her mom is Aunt May.
Cabot.
Cele Cabot was Aunt May. And at one point I gave her, during the course of our show, I gave her a brand new copy of that album that I had found. And she said to me, would it be okay with me if she gave it to her mom? So I said, of course, and unfortunately, I never got to meet her mom. I did meet her dad, the famous comedy magician Carl Ballantyne. And I wrote a part for him in the show just so that I could get to meet him. But I suppose if I had been on top of my game, I would have written a part for her mother as well.
Oh, that would have been so cool. Or just like an Aunt May or an alternate universe Aunt May would have been cool or something.
That would have been great. Yeah. I missed out on that opportunity. But we did get her dad into the show. So
we talk about these story arcs, the alien costume. Challenges in bringing that story arc to Fox Kids. I mean, we're talking about Venom. Mm-hmm. We talk about some – I mean, obviously – there are some limits that you have when we talk about censorship, but with some of the characters in the comics, they do get, especially later seasons, Carnage comes in. In the comic books, he's a serial killer. So the challenges of bringing that particular saga to the series.
There's always a way. I like the challenge, to be honest with you. It's sort of like figuring out a puzzle. Because what I didn't do, I didn't compromise on any of the characters. The personalities are still there. we just didn't see them do the deed. So we didn't see them kill anyone. And you can still imply that they're just as deranged. I think that the way that Venom terrorizes Mary Jane is far more frightening than if he put his hands around her and choked her to death. I borrowed a little bit from Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train with that one. And I really think that that's a very powerful episode. So, you know, and just the disruption to Peter's life, I think that's a very disturbing, that's a really disturbing episode, though, you know, that third episode. It's really kind of for a little kid, I think it's really pretty heavy duty. And, you know, again, you don't have to show violence. I mean, that's what Hitchcock teaches. You can have tremendous suspense without violence. And then, of course, later on down the line, he did Psycho. So obviously he went the other way. But
but even in that, I mean, I had a chance to talk to Janet Leigh about that. And she said it's what you don't see. You never see anything in Psycho. Yeah. You never see the knife pierce flesh. You never see it. It's what you think you see. And absolutely. She said that is much more terrifying than any – what you come up with in your brain is much more terrifying than anything you could put on the screen.
Absolutely. And I think that that's an important lesson that I learned from just being a film buff. And, you know, I'd done some writing about film. Everything you need to know about film you can learn from Hitchcock. And the way that you can make people, you know, emote – have your audience emote by just cinematic manipulation. I was very into that, and I put a lot of that into especially that last episode of Venom. But it was an exciting those three episodes were tremendously exciting. We got for the episode number one, we obviously got the feature animation unit at TMS because that has some spectacular animation in it. And we used to screen these episodes on the big screen when they came in at New World. We were in the New World building at that time, and there was a screening room. And so we would look at them on a big screen, and they were like movies. I mean, I was always amazed that we were literally making 22-minute movies every week. And that three-episode arc, I think, really worked out pretty well. And if you're on my page, you would have seen that it was not initially going to be three episodes. It was going to be two. And I had initiated the writing of both the episodes. And then it occurred to me that we were really cheating the audience by not doing the black suit, Spider-Man having the black suit. So at the last minute, I convinced everyone that we needed to stick an episode in the middle and do the black suit episode and dovetail it, you know, into the third episode. And it worked out really well.
Well, and that was such a huge element of the comic books, too. So when you think about that and you think about, you know, episodes like... the Insidious Six or the takeoff on the Sinister Six, Morbius, based on the classic comic books, the issues 101 and 102, Goblin War, you know, Spider-Man issue 312, all these different, the wedding of Peter Parker. How do you take these elements of the comic books? How do you decide at that time which elements are going to work, how closely of an adaptation you can make, and how much just needs to be jettisoned and make it just maybe the concept but go in a different direction?
Well, one of the greatest compliments that anyone ever pays me is when they say, hey, your show is just like the comic book. And I always feel very proud about that because my show is actually nothing like the comic book. But it gives the illusion that it's just like the comic book. And that was exactly what I wanted to do. The challenge was to pull elements out of the comic books and integrate them into a really great, you know, kick-ass action-adventure half-hour TV show. This is where it helped that I had been a Spider-Man fan. I was determined to bring Turning Point to life. And so that's a pretty straightforward adaptation. I mean, it really doesn't veer very much from the comic. But most of the rest of it, you know, if you look at something like Morbius and his introduction in the comic book, when I was a kid reading it and Morbius arrived on the scene, it was like, wow, this is the greatest thing ever. Then when I reread it again, in order to get the character into the TV series, I was shocked. It's like one day there's a cave near the beach, and then suddenly there's a vampire in the cave, and he wakes up and goes, hey, I'm awake. I think I'll do evil things. And there's absolutely no justification for his existence.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about simply getting this character on the cover of that issue that week, of that month. And so the trick is to take the character and bring him to life in a way that's exciting and that integrates in the storyline and that works with the characters that have been established. And so that's the trick, you know. I don't believe that Morbius in the beginning even had a human alter ego. He was just Morbius. He just arrived on the scene one day and said, "Hey, I'm Morbius. You know, I want to drink your blood." And so the comic book really was kind of stupid. But you want to bring the character to life and make him credible and give him an interesting role. And that's, you know, that's what I do for a living. That's my job.
And one of the comic book storylines that also isn't completely beloved, maybe like the origin of Morbius for you, the Clone Saga. We talk about the 90s. The original Clone Saga, I remember from the 70s, I always loved. 90s, it got like really crazy in the comic books, and some people loved it, some people hated it. You embraced it and capped the series off with it. So obviously no reservations on your part of tackling the Clone Saga. I love the fact you actually even make a few jokes within it. Well, the one episode title is "I Really, Really Hate Clones."
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think, what was the line you had in there from, sorry, this is starting to sound like a bad comic book plot.
Yes.
Okay, so you obviously get the joke. It's, why tackle that even as a finale for the series? Because that's such a roll of the dice.
Right. Well, the Clone Saga was something that, you know, the comic book company was falling apart at the time, and I think it was a gimmick. They were doing nothing but gimmicks at that time. It was, you know, killing Aunt May and doing this with, you know, the clone thing. And I thought it was really dumb, but I was very committed to giving the fans what they wanted to see. And it was the most significant thing that was going on in the world of Spider-Man at that time. Everybody was asking me. We didn't have the internet at that time, but we had BBSs and BBS forums, and everyone wanted to know, are you going to do the Clone Saga? And I thought, well, if they don't see something, they're gonna be disappointed. And I could have, with Spider-Man, I could have done the Paul Dini thing and created a new character. But I chose not to. I deliberately chose not to, because I thought, you know, people have waited decades to see the Green Goblin and Mysterio and all of these characters brought to life the right way. I don't want to waste any screen time with some new character that they're not familiar with. That's really just, you know, when I could be bringing to life something that they really do want to see. But I threw the clone thing in. In a way, maybe, now that I think back on it, the Clone Saga seemed like a logical extension of what I had done with the Neogenics, and maybe even the multiverse. You know, the multiverse was a way of bringing those kinds of characters and the clone spider clone in without really committing a lot of screen time to it. And you have to forgive me, I'm a little vague sometimes on what happened at the end of the series because I haven't seen it in 20 years. I'm slowly working my way through the series again to refresh my mind, because I want to write a book about the writing of the show.
Oh, okay. That would be amazing. Well, maybe it'll be released when the eventual DVD release, Blu-ray. Well, are we ever going to get this?
I don't think so.
I think it's insane to everybody. Everything's been released on DVD.
I know. It's my fault. I have bad DVD release karma. I made a fairly popular hip hop movie for Warner Brothers called Class Act, which was rap duo Kid and Play,
yeah.
And it's a little bit of a cult favorite. There are some people that really love it. It never got a release. It never got a DVD release. Every Kid and Play movie known to mankind got a DVD release, except Class Act. They finally released Class Act, but it didn't get a mass release. It got a Warner's Archive video on demand release. You know, but this thing follows me where things that I do don't get released. And Spider-Man is part of it. I think that there are several rights issues. Somebody told me not too long ago that the music, the Joe Perry music, might be one of the sticking points.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that
infamous plane ride all those years ago
might have screwed up the DVD release.
Oh, it all goes back to Avi on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Yeah, because I think the Batman TV series rights, there couldn't be more tangled rights than that, and they worked that out.
Well, I think that whenever there's a motivation to work something out, people will. But I don't. That series kind of fell in between the cracks because it was Marvel Films Animation, and then New World owned it. But then New World got acquired, I think, by Fox, and so Fox might have owned it. But then, you know, Fox doesn't want to let Disney release it. It's just a mess.
It's crazy with Spider-Man because you have the Nicholas Hammond TV series. You've got Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, the Spider-Man cartoon around the same time. This one, none of them have official DVD Blu-ray releases. I mean, I guess in Europe or something. But
I think the thing you have to remember is that initially there was a guy at Marvel who delighted in making deals that were non-deals. Okay, these were deals that would fall apart because you know the devil was in the details, and so the rights to Marvel characters would get sold to people, and then people would find out that they didn't have the rights that they needed, or they didn't have the rights that they wanted, or their rights had lapsed, and it was just a mess. And I think that anything that came out of that messy period, when those deals, and this is all, you know, I wasn't in the room when any of this stuff was happening, so this is only my opinion. But, you know, you look at that Fantastic Four debacle with the Roger Corman film thing.
We've had the whole cast on here. We talked about that in depth.
That's a perfect example. You know, I went to a screening of that documentary, which I enjoyed. But that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. You know, it's just all this giant mess of rights. And if Avi is to be praised for anything, he should be praised for cutting through all of that and making a lot of these shows possible during the 90s. You know, Spider-Man wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Avi. His deal-making expertise was really quite amazing at that time, and he should be given a lot of credit for that. I know he hates my guts at this particular point in time, but I actually respect a lot of what he did in terms of getting things made. That's cool. That's cool.
You asked about that finale. I mean, it is a pretty cool finale. I mean, you've got, and I've heard you, you're serving your penance over this for not having Peter and Mary Jane in the final scene. He does get to meet her at the end. We know he does. And
Madam Webb says to him, "I'm going to take you to find, you know, we're going to go get Mary Jane." I figured that was enough, you know. And I've said this in the past, and people are tired of hearing it. If you're talking about the series as kind of like the hero's journey, then when Peter Parker goes to Stan Lee, his creator, and says, "I like myself now, I'm not the character you created anymore," that's really the end. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, he has found himself, and he is now willing to accept the hero that he is. He saved all of reality, not all of mankind, not all of Earth, but all of reality. You really can't top that. So for me, the ending was the end, you know, and then, you know, the old woman says, "You're going to get the girl. Let's go get her," you know? And if I had had it at the end where she said, "Well, let's go to 7-Eleven. I'll buy you a Coke," no one would be tormented over whether or not he got the Coke.
Yeah. Face a tiger, you just hit the jackpot. It's like, okay, really?
Yeah. You know, if I had ended it with them kissing.
Yeah.
Everyone would say, "Oh God, what a sappy ending!" Yeah. You know?
No, I think it works. I like it. I think it works. I mean, did you write the whole web swinging thing with Stanley, knowing that might be the end?
I knew it was the end. It was the end. There was no question in my mind, and the politics were such that I knew the show wasn't going to get picked up.
Okay.
I don't think Fox was ever terribly excited about being in business with Avi, and there was all kinds of animosity and all kinds of bullshit. I know people get very angry when I talk about this, but, you know, I was there. Sorry. There was no chance. New World was shutting down. New World, had gone bankrupt and was shutting down. And there was no more money to do anything. Yeah, all animation is deficit financed. It doesn't pay for itself. The show was deficit financed by a company that no longer really could afford to make anything anymore. That's why the next Spider-Man show was made by Saban, because Marvel Films Animation simply ceased to exist. We were not going to get any more episodes. I knew it was absolutely the end.
No, so, that was a pretty cool closer. I mean, Spider-Man began with Stan Lee, he ends with Stan Lee. So
there you
it
go.
Makes total there sense. And we do get to find out what happened to Mary Jane in one of your perks for War of the Rocket Men, correct?
Yes. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the Kickstarter campaign. You're bringing the whole cast back. Christopher Daniel Barnes.
Thank you for
the plug. Saratoga Valentine. We've got the Kickstarter going, and we do get to find out. Tell us a little bit about War of the Rocket Men and what we can expect.
All right. Here's what makes War of the Rocket Men cool. I am bringing the entire cast of Spider-Man the Animated Series back, including Ed Asner. I'm going to get them all into a room together, if I can. So one of the perks that we're offering is the opportunity to get into the room with all of these guys. So if you're a big fan of the show, if you're willing to pay the big bucks, you could physically be in the room with the cast of Spider-Man the Animated Series.
Nice.
That's history. That is history. I have written, let's assume that I had been given another episode and that I did bring Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson together again. I have written a kind of a, not really one episode, but a bit of a, kind of a little mini series, a little mini series in script form that describes how that would have all played out. And there's a little autobiographical aspect to it as well, where I talk about what went on in my mind when I wrote the ending and all of that kind of stuff. Anyway, that script will be given to anyone who donates the minimum amount that we're asking, which is $25. For $25 on the War of the Rocket Men crowdfunding campaign, you get that script. You'll also get a PDF of that script. You get a PDF of the Bible, the show Bible for War of the Rocket Men, with really great art by a bunch of great artists like Des Taylor. You'll get a certificate making you a member of the Rocket Man Squadron. That certificate is designed by another great artist, Frank Grau. Here's the thing. Forget about Peter Finds Mary Jane, which I think in and of itself justifies the $25. But in addition to that, you will get a ticket, a virtual ticket. I recorded over 3 hours of video of our recording sessions. I had my then brand new high 8mm video camera. I ran the camera through the entire recording session. I did this a couple of times. I did this for the very final recording session, the one that Stan came to.
Oh, wow.
And then I put this video away and completely forgot that it existed. I dug it out, and I was stunned to find out that, A, there was so much of it, and, B, that it was as interesting as it was, because you're going to get to actually watch probably an episode being recorded that might be your favorite episode. Who knows? I'm going to make this footage available for the first time ever and probably the only time. You're also maybe going to get to see some rough cuts of what the show was like when we got it sent from overseas, because I have a whole bunch of what we call original deliveries, where sometimes there'd be a little more animation that we cut out, or there might be lines. I had the benefit of having a character whose mouth was covered up, so I would change his lines right up until literally weeks before we aired sometimes. And so you'll get to hear what the original line was supposed to be. I'll give you, for instance, in Night of the Lizard, when Spider-Man looks up and sees Mrs. Connors about to grab the gun, he says to her, "Mrs. Connors, pick up the gun and fire it at the lizard." I mean, he's literally telling her what to do. And when I looked at that, when we got the rough cut in, I looked at it and I thought, well, that's pretty stupid. I mean, that's the hero telling this poor woman, save the day. it was just wrong. It was a mistake. And so I changed it where he's telling her not to pick up the gun because it's dangerous. That's an example. I mean, I still have the original cut where he's saying, pick up the gun, you know, save the day.
Okay.
You know, those are the kinds of, those are growing pains. You know, you make mistakes like that and you look at them and you go, ooh, sure glad I have a hero whose mouth is covered up. And then you fix it. And that's the kind of thing that you might see when we do this virtual streaming. It's not instant. Somebody asked me, so if I make a donation, do I get this right away? No, that's not how it works. We wait until the entire campaign is over and then I have to prepare the material. I have to get it together and I have to upload it. But you will have access to it once it gets uploaded. Now, the only people who are going to have access to this are the people who have a virtual ticket. And the way to get a virtual ticket is to make any kind of a donation. I think the minimum donation that we're requesting for perks is $25. That's a small amount. You get a whole lot of really cool stuff. You know, the Peter Finds Mary Jane. It's a wonderful deal if you're a Spider-Man fan. War of the Rocketmen in and of itself is an idea that has always been very appealing to me. I love Old Republic serials. I love the Rocketman character. I'm taking something like the Rocketman character and making it my own. I've got a whole new cast of characters. The voices will be performed by our Spider-Man cast. But it's going to be very, it's like, I mean, I'm going to be doing it. It's going to be just like the 90s action adventure animation that, you've all come to love. Just the way I wrote Spider-Man. What I'm doing is I'm putting together a presentation that will literally be a 22-minute pilot without animation. It'll be an animatic. So it'll be, I'm recording the storyboard, which is going to be drawn by my fine artists, my wonderful artists. And then it will have the soundtrack, sound effects, music. So it'll be like watching the pilot without the expensive animation being done. That's a pilot I'm then going to take around and see if I can sell as a series. So what you're doing with the donation is you're helping me make the pilot, but you're also going to have the opportunity to get all these wonderful Spider-Man related perks, autographs. People are always asking me, can I have an autograph? If you want to get my autograph on a storyboard or a script or a comic book or any of these kinds of things, all of that's going to be available now.
There you go. And like we talked about with Christopher Daniel Barnes, I mean, set in one of my favorite time periods, we talk about, because I love Raiders of the Lost Ark, the 40s, and, they're battling Nazis. You've got Nazi rocket men. You've got Allied rocket men going at it. Is it going to be – because I've seen some of the drawings and I've seen some of the look of it. Are you kind of going maybe toward a Fleischer, like maybe a combination of the Fleischer cartoons, the Batman, that whole sort of noirish kind of look?
Yeah, I very much like
giant robots and things or something.
Absolutely, the pulp covers brought to life.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's Republic serials. It's the old pulp science fiction covers brought to life. It's the Max Fleischer cartoons, which are different from, everyone sort of says, well, when Bruce Timm did Superman, he was going for the Fleischer look. Well, actually, the Fleischer look is really very different from what Bruce Timm did with Superman, and I want to go more for the Fleischer look. And that just that wonderful feeling of vintage and the period, I love all that stuff. And that's really what I want to bring to life here. That's the whole purpose of doing this. I'm not trying to sell a toy, and I'm certainly not looking for work because I'm gainfully employed. So for me, this is a labor of love, and I want it to really come across as a labor of love. The 1940s, World War II, the Nazis, the Rocket Man. Need I say more?
It's and the cast of Spider-Man. It's going to be great too. And another one that's coming up too. We're looking at, is it August or in the fall? You're going to be debuting. Now, you've done some independent comic work, but
a little bit.
Okay, but this is like kind of your first jump into the big publishing waters of comic books with DC Cyborg, right? Rebirth.
Yeah. Everyone always asks me, why don't you do a comic book for Marvel? Well, Marvel never asked me to do a comic book for them.
You did 65 episodes of a comic.
that's the impediment there, is they have to kind of ask you. But my good friends at DC did ask. Dan DiDio, whom I've known for a good number of years, he asked me to come and do a comic book. And a gentleman by the name of Dan Evans, who did me a wonderful favor of reminding them that I was available to do a comic book, and throwing my name into the hat. They got right back to me, and I met Jeff Johns, who is a brilliant guy. He deserves all the kudos that he gets, and I'm very lucky to know him. I'm very lucky to be in a room with him. I'm working with some wonderful editors. This is my first mainstream comic book. I'm doing Cyborg. He's obviously a very important character. He's part of the Justice League, and he's slated to have his own movie, I think sometime in 2018 or something like that.
We saw him appear in Batman v Superman, so he's there. He's in that movie universe that's coming up.
Nobody was more shocked than I was to see that.
And you're on the inside.
And I'm on the inside. I was sitting there at the screening. I was sitting next to, you ready for this? I was sitting next to Alan Burnett and Paul Dini. We were sitting together. I had run into them in the lobby, and we all went upstairs, and we sat together. All of a sudden, there's the birth of Cyborg. And I went, hey, that looks familiar. I know that character. But that was pretty cool because that demonstrated how serious DC is to making this character very prominent. So I'm very honored to be handling him I have written one issue. We're getting the artwork in right now by Paul Pelletier, which is really brilliant. This thing looks so great. It's like an epic, you know, motion picture on paper. And I'm very delighted to be a part of this. It should be on the stands in August. I have all kinds of wonderful stuff. I'll tell you a funny thing that happened. I came up with a plot point that was very far-fetched and futuristic and reaching into the advances in technology that I thought was maybe even a little too far-fetched. And then I got online the next day. I literally had handed in the outline, and I got online the next day, and there was my idea being discussed as a reality. Someone had just gotten the approval from a government agency to pursue the idea that I had put in my story. And I literally had to send out, you know, an email to my editors and say, guys, this is a really amazing coincidence, but I did not see this article before I wrote this story.
For listeners who aren't as familiar with the cyborg, I mean, we all know Superman, Batman, but for those that aren't as familiar with the cyborg character, what can you tell us about Cyborg and Rebirth from DC Comics? What is all this? This is the huge thing that's going on in the world of DC Comics right now.
It is indeed. We had a huge press conference at WonderCon about a month or so ago. They're basically revisiting. It's not like the New 52 where they're starting from scratch, but what they're doing is they're saying, okay, we're going to start looking at these characters all over again in a different way, and we're going to really reinvigorate them. And Dan DiDio, he said this during the press conference, that they felt that they had kind of lost their way a little bit, that the fans were not happy. And so they're going to try to do things better and make just a whole new, better wave of comic books. So, they're calling it Rebirth. I obviously am a part of that effort because I'm not a regular comic book guy. So I'm kind of bringing fresh perspective to my particular title. But Cyborg is a guy who got caught in a horrible explosion, and his father, who was a brilliant scientist, used some unproven alien technology to bring him, or to prevent him from dying, by fusing him with technology, by making him half human and half half cyborg, you know, half robot, half mechanical, half technological. He is really the living embodiment of what Ray Kurzweil calls the singularity, which is the merging of biology with technology. And now he's at the forefront of that. He can literally tap into any network. He can tap into any satellite and get satellite imagery, you know, beamed directly to his brain. He can go through databases in his brain. He's just an amazing character. I don't think that he has reached the heights of being the kind of superhero that he can be. So my goal with this series is to make him every bit as significant as Superman or Batman.
How do you do that? Because we talk about characters and caring about characters and mm-hmm. not just stuff blowing up and explosions and, you know, these things. What do you plan to do with this character to make us care about him and to kind of bring us into this world? And what can we expect?
Well, it's the same thing I did with Spider-Man, which is to not look at it as Spider-Man. Not, you know, I used to always tell my writers, we're not doing the Spider-Man show, we're doing the Peter Parker show. And he happens to be Spider-Man. But if we don't care about Peter Parker, we're not really going to care about what Spider-Man is doing. I think the problem that has existed in the Cyborg comic is that Vic's personality and his life has never been fully explored. And we don't really know who he is. We know who Cyborg is. We know what his powers are. But, you know, that's like staring at a toy and moving him around on a tabletop. But if you don't know who the character really is and what his personality is, you're not as invested as you could be. So I'm building out his world. Vic's accident happened when he was about, I don't know, I'm going to say 20. I haven't written down exactly what age he is, but I'm going to say he's roughly 20. You know, he was a football hero in college. What kind of a life did he have prior to any of that, prior to the accident happening? You know, he must have had a girlfriend. He must have had friends. None of this has been explored. None of it. And I'm going to tell the story of Vic. And in doing so, we're going to find out a lot of things we didn't know about him. I think my editors are very surprised sometimes with what I come up with. It's like, what? What are you talking about? You know, but it's fun for me because I think he's a really interesting character. And I think that people have not been exposed to how interesting a character he is. And then there's the cyborg stuff. You know, I mean, Cyborg already is fascinating. There are a lot of cyborg fans out there. But I think that Vic has been something of a mystery up until now, and we're going to explore that. He's also wrestling with a lot of issues that I don't think have been fully explored up until now. Is he, in fact, really human still? He's not entirely sure. And the question of what is it to be human versus what is it to be a machine, as the two merge, as we get closer and closer, when do you stop being human and when do you become a machine and vice versa? And is there such a thing as a soul? And, you know, because if there is, Vic needs to know about it right away, because believe me, he's right at the cutting edge of not knowing and whether or not, you know, such a thing exists. He needs to know in order to get through his life. So we're going to explore all of that. It's going to be a very interesting comic book.
You mentioned you're working with Jeff Johns, and he's a creative force behind a lot of even the live action stuff, you know, the stuff they're doing on TV, the stuff they're doing in the movies. Are there elements where, you don't have to be specific, obviously you can't talk about specifics, but are there elements where they're coming in saying, we're hoping to do this in the movie, can you plant some seeds in the comic book, or can you tie in this at all? Or are they just, you don't have anything to deal with that?
No. Well, what Jeff has told me is he said, you know, the world is yours, play with it. And you never know, anything you create might end up in a movie.
Okay. So there you go. So put some really cool stuff in. Yeah. Detroit's going to be happy to hear this. I guess we're going to get to see Detroit a lot. So
you are. And in fact, that was one of the first things that I realized was that, you know, here you've got a guy who lives in Detroit. He's a black man living in Detroit, and that is a whole reality that has never been explored in the cyborg comic book. So, you know, I looked at that and I thought, wow, there's a whole thing in and of itself. But Jeff's been great. You know, Jeff is extraordinarily excited about this character and invested in this character. He wants it to really be successful. I think that he has placed a great deal of responsibility in my hands, and I couldn't be more delighted. This is the first dream gig I've gotten after Spider-Man. I think maybe in between was a little bit of my time on Static Shock, where I was working with Dwayne McDuffie and Dennis Cowan.
Yeah, you can talk about it. Your team got nominated for an Emmy on that one, right?
We did. We shared an Emmy nomination. I share a nomination with Dwayne McDuffie, and Dwayne, of course, is legendary. And Dennis, who is truly a gentleman. Dennis was one of the people when I was over there at Warner's who was very helpful to me and supportive. And you know, I know Dennis gets a lot of attention. I don't think Dennis gets as much attention as he deserves because he really is a very cool guy. And a pioneer. You know, shout out to Dennis, and thank you for always being a good guy. I had a great time working over there on that show. I came in third season, and then we miraculously got a fourth, which no one was expecting, and we got the Emmy nomination. That was fun. I wasn't in control of that show. I was one of the story editors, and that wasn't entirely my show. But Spider-Man was, and now Cyborg is entirely mine to do as I will. So my goal is to make it a hugely successful comic book and make this character very prominent so that by the time that movie comes around in 2018, people are just, you know, champing at the bit to see the character brought to life.
I think we already are after seeing him in Batman v Superman. It was always kind of nice to see those little mini origin stories in that. Can find out about all these things at your website, right? johnsemper.com?
Well, there is johnsemper.com, but actually the website to go to for Spider-Man is cartoonspiderman.com. The best place to go for me is the Facebook page, facebook.com/Making of Spider-Man the Animated Series. That's all one word, Making of Spider-Man the Animated Series. There's also for War of the Rocket Men, and please donate. It's www.waroftherocketmen.com, all one word, War of the Rocket Men. The link for the Indiegogo campaign of War of the Rocket Men is igg.me/@WarOfTheRocketMen.
And fortunately for folks, we'll put all those links in the show notes at my website. It's comicbookcentral.net. Hey, John, continued success, and I thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me on, Joe. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you for letting me talk forever, and I wish you the best of luck with everything you do.
Lot going on in the world of John Semper Jr. He is a busy guy, and he was very generous with his time, as you could tell. So again, my thanks to him for joining us today here on Comic Book Central to talk about Spider-Man, Cyborg, Rocket Man. Now, as of this episode, there are still a couple weeks left to go to get in on those perks that John mentioned for the War of the Rocket Man Indiegogo campaign. I think it ends somewhere about a week and a half into June, so depending on when you're listening to this, go check it out. Only a few days left, so go check it out. Some amazing perks there. Really cool to see this project come to life. That link and all of the links, and I know there were a bunch of them that we talked about today, they can all be found in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. That is the online hub of the lair. On the homepage, comicbookcentral.net, you're also going to find links to follow Comic Book Central on Twitter. It's at comicbookctrl if you want to go there right on Twitter. Like it on Facebook. You'll find a link there on the website. Subscribe in iTunes. There's a button there. You can do that. If you're in iTunes, don't forget to leave a review in iTunes. Always love to hear what you folks out there have to say, and it helps get the show recognized. Share the lair. Hashtag share the lair on Twitter. Share the show link on Facebook. Retweet it on Twitter. As always, my thanks to each and every one of you who not only listen to the show, but are working to get the word out. You guys are retweeting it. It's working, folks. It's getting out to more and more people. I really appreciate that. And I want to hear from you directly. Be sure to drop me a line. Click the Signal Me tab on the website. Send me an email, joe@comicbookcentral.net. I want to know what you think of the show. And with that, I will web up my look back at Spider-Man, the animated series. Thanks, of course, to Ed Asner, Christopher Daniel Barnes, and, of course, John Semper Jr. for joining me today. Had an amazing time chatting with those talented gents. I am sure there's going to be more Spidey animated goodness in future episodes. I love the show. Love the cast. I know you do, too. I will be revisiting it soon. Now, folks, back in February, I brought you five Flash-themed episodes, and I promised you at the time that there were more on the way. Well, that promise is about to be kept, because next week on Comic Book Central, the Flash is wrapped, the Season 2 finale has aired, and it is a long wait until fall, but you will only have to wait a few days to hear from someone who is no stranger to the goings-on at Star Labs, the soon-to-be speedster, Jesse Wells, a.k.a. Jesse Quick, actress Violet Bean. She will be here on the very next episode. I hope you will sit down with us as well. Until then, go check out the Spidey perks on John's Indiegogo campaign. They're awesome. Keep reading those comics, especially Cyborg. And thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Saratoga, I ran over here as soon as I got your message. What's wrong?
Chris, he's back.
Oh, no. Not again.
Yes, again. He's been stalking and harassing me for years. He stands out there in the street, wearing nothing but a wrinkly old raincoat in the dark every night.
Oh, good grief.
And every time I step out my front door to go somewhere, he shouts about how he wants to hit the jackpot, too. Or, let me hit the jackpot, too. I need to hit the jackpot, too. Oh, I used to love saying Mary Jane Watson's famous opening line. Now he's made me sick of it.
That is so twisted. It's disgusting.
Doesn't he understand that I am not Mary Jane Watson? I'm Saratoga Ballantyne, an actress. I only played Mary Jane Watson in the greatest Spider-Man animated series ever made. I mean, you played Spider-Man, and nobody follows you around asking to touch your web shooter.
Well, I guess you played your role too well. In the series, your voice was incredibly sexy and alluring. Now that man out there is obsessed with you.
Well, I couldn't help it. The writing, artwork, animation was just so brilliant. Well, it's no wonder that that series is still so popular after all these years.
True, but the downside is, now you have a stalker.
He just will not give up. When he stands out there like that, drooling, he even frightens my poor neighbors.
Do you want me to go out there and shoo him away?
Would you please? I know it'll only make him go away for a little while, but any kind of break is better than nothing. I have to water my roses.
Sure thing. I'll go do it right now. You! Ed Asner! Go away!
Blast you, Chris Barnes! You party pooper!
You're being a real nuisance. Now go away!
Are you sure Saratoga Valentine won't come out and see me? Tell her I want to hit the jackpot tonight, tiger!
Ed Asner, you are an embarrassment to old people. Sarah doesn't want you hanging around in her neighborhood in your dirty old raincoat. Good grief, man, you're a TV legend. Now act like one. Go home and polish your Emmys. And keep your raincoat closed.
You're no fun. Tell her I'll be back tomorrow. I'm gonna go home now and play with my Mary Jane Watson inflatable doll.
Go! Folks, there's only one way you can stop this from happening again. Please put Ed Asner back to work. In fact, you can put all of the cast of Spider-Man, the animated series, to work by donating to the crowdfunding campaign for our new show, War of the Rocket Men. It's a brand new animated show created by John Semper Jr., the producer and head writer of Spider-Man, the animated series. It's inspired by the old adventure serials of the 30s and 40s. We're going to bring back the thrilling TV adventure animation of the 90s, and it's all up to you. To everyone who donates, we're giving away one-of-a-kind Spider-Man collectibles and experiences that you'll never be able to get once this campaign is over. So go to the website on the screen and donate now. And let's keep Ed Asner busy so that he won't be stalking Saratoga anymore. Please, donate right now.